This is Views from the Watershed.
Episode 4, Working in the Watershed. Part 1, Hard Work. We are at the Ashokan Quarry Trail. Here, 120 years ago, stone was cut out of the ground, put onto rail cars, and moved 3 miles north where it was used to build the Ashokan Reservoir. It's very quiet here. The only sounds are birds, the wind in the trees, and a few hikers. But back in the day, it was dusty, noisy, and hazardous, full of the sounds of men and machinery. Previously, you've heard about the water, policy, and social infrastructures that make the New York City water system in the Catskills what it is today. Now you'll hear about the labor infrastructure that made it all possible, and about the thousands of people who built the system over 60 years. We'll hear again from Catskills historian, Diane Galusha.
The workers are sort of the invisible part of this massive infrastructure project. Human people like you and me actually built these amazing structures. I've often marveled at their skill and fortitude and what they put up with to work in really difficult circumstances. Didn't get paid much, just needed to work to support families or send money back home or whatever they did with it. It's a personal story as much as it is a public work story.
The first part of the system to be constructed was the Ashokan Reservoir and the Catskills Aqueduct. This difficult, dangerous work began at a time when we didn't have the machines and the technology that we do now.
The Catskill Aqueduct was truly a feat of engineering and, of course, construction to get the water 8 miles in from the Hudson to New York City, 120 miles or something, to the south, with a river in between. And also to navigate this rocky, hilly terrain, cross underneath streams, pierce mountains, and then go underneath the Hudson River, 1,100 feet under the Hudson River. You know, it's one thing to put it on paper. Then you got to have people build them. You have to have people who are tough and can endure terrible weather. They worked all year long. It was a really difficult thing to do. They weren't just building reservoirs and tunnels, you know. There was a lot of stuff that had to happen before they could even begin to do that. Carpentry shops, blacksmith shops, storehouses, the work roads, bridges, and the grubbing was a huge part of it. Grubbing is removing all traces of humanity from the basin floor. And there was a lot of manual labor that was required that would later be done by heavy machinery. Men and horses and mules did much of the work, four-wheeled wagons and such. There were power plants for air compressors and steam generation to run drills and engines. There were steam shovels. There were cableways that brought cement and sand and stone from different directions. There were quarries. There were stone crushers. There were mixing plants. Those quarries are actually still able to be seen. You can hike to some of them and ponder the life of somebody who had found himself maybe 2 months ago was living in Italy and today is sitting in a quarry in the Catskills, making a buck a day to build something that would outlast him and all of us for centuries.
Diane, tell me about the workers who built the system.
The vast majority of the people, maybe 80-85% of workers on the Ashokan were immigrants, and most of those were from Italy. But there were many languages spoken in those camps, Hungarian, Russian, Slavic languages. Many of the people who worked there migrated from Pennsylvania, where they worked in the coal mines. So they had mining experience and were sought to work in those tunnels. The workforce for the Ashokan Reservoir did include a large contingent of African-American workers from the South. They didn't live with the rest of the workers. They were segregated. That's, you know, another invisible subset of people who produced this engineering feat and construction feat.
During the construction of the Ashokan, workers lived in camps that were built to house them. What were they like?
The camps were really like little cities. The main camps had streets and street lights, multiple schools for children of those immigrant families. recreation hall where they could read newspapers in their own language. Staffers from various social agencies would come and provide entertainment or provide assistance or education, teaching people English. There were sewage systems. There was a pretty elaborate food production system, 5,000 loaves a day of bread that they made. They had to feed all these people in addition to house them. But you know what? It cost them. They spent 65% of their earnings for room and board. You know, it wasn't free, but it wasn't a terrible way to live. When you think about how immigrants were crammed into tenements in New York City and were struggling to make a living there, this seemed more humane, actually. The main camp, for instance, in the Ashokan Reservoir was built in a semicircle below the dam site. And it included barracks and dormitory housing for single men, cottages or small houses for families.
Were people paid well for their work?
Back in the early reservoir projects, the pay scale was pretty minimal. It was like $1 a day, $1.20 a day, and for a common laborer, a little bit more if you handled explosives or were an electrician or something. So a lot of local folks shied away from those jobs because they could get the same amount of money working on dad's farm or somebody else's farm. Periodically, the workers would strike or try to get more money. In the Delaware projects, you were making $1.50 an hour. That actually was considered decent money. They took those jobs rather than stay on the farm. They would rather have a job that you could work 8 hours a day instead of working 16 hours a day on the farm.
Diane, in your book, Liquid Assets, about the history of the water system, you detail the injuries and deaths that happened over the course of this 60-year project, the number of which was especially high during the construction of the Catskill system.
It was a very dangerous environment to work in. Narrow gauge railroads were everywhere on these sites, both on the surface and in the tunnels. Many people were crushed between cars or run over. There were obviously falling rocks in the tunnels and at excavation sites around the reservoir basin. There were mules and horses, and you could get hit by a runaway wagon or fall off a scaffolding, fall off the top of the dam. A lot of dynamite in the tunnels and just blasting rock in the quarries. There were other things that were unforeseen, like swarms of bees and floods and snowstorms. There were a lot of communicable diseases in that day and age. If you got hurt and your wound was infected, there weren't antibiotics that you could just take care of that. That was a potential killer. And there were any number of ways to get hurt and to get killed, and many people did. You know, there weren't safety harnesses and hard hats. You were on your own. You live or you don't.
A lot changed between the construction of the Catskill system and the Delaware system. The work was still hazardous, but there was a lot more government regulation on safety and worker protections.
You had to be a dues-paying union member to get the job. The Ashokan was finished in the teens and the Schoharie in the mid-20s, and the Rondout and Neversink were finished around 1950 or so. In the intervening years, technology changed and construction processes changed with the advent of diesel engines and other advances that allowed the work to go on day and night. The Delaware system found workers with hearing loss because there was a lot more equipment that made a lot of noise. I mean, it was just a really, really noisy place, and it was 24 hours a day. And there was also the terror that some men felt going to work for the first time in those tunnels and getting in the elevator with a bunch of other men and descending 600 feet. It's dark. It's cold. It's wet. It's claustrophobic, and a lot of people didn't last very long down there. They got right back in the elevator, and they went right back up to the surface because they couldn't handle it. You had to have a certain steely resolve to lower yourself into the center of the earth and chip away at ancient rock towards some eventual goal of sending water to millions of people that you will never know, and they will never know you.
How did the living conditions change in the time between the construction of the Catskill system and the Delaware system?
In those early projects, because of the transportation situation, they lived on site until it was done. But in those Delaware projects, people were much more mobile. A whole subset of workers who were kind of professional public works employees would travel around the country looking for these big jobs and became this mobile workforce. And about this time in the 50s or so, the mobile home became a possibility. You could just pull your house wherever you needed it to go and park there for the next 4 years while you worked there and then move on to the next job. So there was this cohort of public works construction workers who brought their families and their kids enrolled in the local schools for the duration. There was also local folks who worked there and in many cases worked on projects that were actually displacing their families, which I always found very poignant. But when you needed a job, you needed a job. Workers left when the reservoir was completed. Some stayed. I've talked to several people who had their early encounter with the Catskills was when they came here to work on the reservoirs and then came back because they remembered how beautiful it was. I think there is a sense of real pride among people who worked on these projects. They point to what stands there now and will for eternity and say, I did that. I helped with that. They told their kids that, and their kids told their kids that. And even though they weren't necessarily recognized for it at the time, there was no real public recognition, they did their part, and they're proud of it, and rightly so. It's a lasting point of pride in many families who may have conflicting emotions about what it cost the communities that were lost, but still there's no denying the accomplishment.
Part 2, Trout and Tourism.
We're at the western end of the Ashokan Rail Trail. If you walk a little ways down it, you'll reach a bridge over Esopus Creek just before the point where it flows into the reservoir. Most days you'll see anglers in the water. This is a popular spot for fly fishing. The fishing community and fish themselves are important stakeholders in the watershed, and their lives and livelihoods depend on how the city manages its water.
So much of what we think we're seeking in the Catskill, which is this notion of wild, say untouched, is actually quite the opposite, and ironically created by the biggest city on the planet. My name's Todd Spire. This is my 14th season fishing the Esopus, lifelong angler. The story surrounding fly fishing here in the Catskills is so amazing, both historically, geologically, biologically. The Catskills as a whole is often revered as the birthplace of American fly fishing. A lot of the firsts actually happened here on this river, including America's first fishing resort, just a couple miles from where we are now. Milo Barber is basically downtown Phoenicia, where the Stony Clove hits. There's a 90-acre fishing resort right there. You just have an enormous amount of history entangled with this river. The Hudson River School painters, actually, most of them were anglers. Ironically, Thomas Cole was one of the only non-anglers in that whole group of painters. The fact that that birth of outdoor recreation was tied to paintings that were made by anglers in this very place, they're completely inseparable. So tourism and fishing really go hand in hand. The other component of fishing history as it relates to the history of the Catskills is the creation of the reservoir system. The impoundment of the waters for the sake of New York City actually improved the conditions for trout fishing here. Almost all of these rivers of the Catskills would be warm water fisheries. In fact, the West Branch of the Delaware, the famed fishing spot, didn't become a trout fishery until 1965. It's man-made because of the cold water releases that we get from these headwater dams. Before those western reservoirs came online, the West Branch of the Delaware was known as a bass fishery. These trout fisheries now survive because of the impoundment, not in spite of it. However, the number of stakeholders is far higher in the West Branch of the Delaware. New York and Pennsylvania also have New Jersey who has some interest in those waters. So it's very politicized as far as how those releases are managed. And there's a lot of fishing economy out there. It's a lot of money that comes into that community through fishing. Communities below the dam are outside of the concerns of New York City. And there's some serious frustrations for the Delaware communities not knowing what's coming to them from a water release standpoint. But those relationships are getting better and better year by year. There are stocked fish, there are wild fish, which is self-propagating, and then there are native fish, completely untouched by the hands of man. The only trout that's native to the eastern part of the country at all is a brook trout. That's the state fish of New York, and was the only trout present in these waters until stocking programs began. Back in the time of the Milo Barber Resort, it was exclusively brook trout. There weren't stocked fish yet. There are reports of anglers catching literally thousands of fish on a weekend. The reason that there were so many fish is that the rivers were smaller, protected by tree cover. Waters were colder. They were ice cold, super clean, super clear mountain water. So fish populations would thrive. And that's why people were able to catch so many fish back then. However, the brook trout on several occasions were completely fished out. The rainbow trout is native to the western part of the United States and the Pacific Rim. Rainbow trout here are so strong, even a tiny little fish will fight like a fish twice its size. It's very exciting to catch rainbow trout in this river. The Esopus was just declared a wild trout fishery at the end of 2020, with this river not receiving any stock trout. It's very exciting. It's an incredible opportunity to prove to fisheries managers just how resilient rivers can be when left to their own devices. We have constant turbidity here in very concentrated periods of time when they are doing releases. Turbidity is a measurement of mud in the water. Rainbow trout really need to see their prey before hitting it. It's far more difficult to fish with a fly in muddy water, but we have found a way to accept that we can't control Mother Nature every step of the way. The portal, which is what keeps this river alive with an influx of cold water and keeps the trout fishery healthy, has been under repair for years. The city finally opened it up. It's another example of this kind of symbiotic relationship between the city's control of our water and our need for it for our local economies to thrive. The city has their finger on the button. They control the releases exclusively. And it's an interesting relationship where the city of New York has more control over a massive resource than the state. The city needs us for water. We, in return, have these tourism-driven economies where we take money from the people who live in the city in order to survive. We also take monies in the form of low-interest small business development grants and loans from the city that help us provide that very service. We are in many ways beholden to the city, but we are also hindered by that relationship. There's four things you can do in a tourism-driven economy. You can feed people, you can house them, you can sell them stuff, or you can give them something to do. My local economy in Phoenicia is very much dependent on things like the river and fishing, and there's three fishing shops here and lots of people employed as guides. I know plenty of people who live here because of me. They lived downstate and they came up and they had a wonderful fishing experience and they became addicted to fishing, and then they came and they bought a place and now I can't afford a place. And so I'm literally part of the problem, and I have to sort of live with that. Municipalities struggle to maintain a tax roll when the city sucks up all that land and keeps it at the lowest possible tax rate. This is developable land where people could live. At the same time, just knowing the way that humans live and interact with each other and develop whatever they can, we wouldn't have this beautiful park if it had been left to its own devices. What's important is to start to recognize and acknowledge that the relationship is symbiotic. We need them and they need us. And it has to become a little less terse in order for us to live a happy existence up here in these mountains. And what I see in these generations are people who want to be good stewards of the river. What's interesting, if you talk to one scientist within the DEP, whomever you're talking to, their argument is always compelling. If you talk to somebody below the reservoir, their argument will be very compelling. And if you talk to me, my argument will be very compelling. You have to start to embody multiple viewpoints simultaneously. You have to start to embody complexity and look at issues from top to bottom. There is no one single way to manage this river to keep every stakeholder happy. And every stakeholder has a certain right, and every stakeholder has a certain opinion, and every stakeholder also has some innate needs. For me, the way that this river is managed is actually tied to my livelihood. So of course, you know, I'm going to advocate for things that are going to protect the trout and protect this fishery. And somebody might turn around and say, well, what about people? You care more about fish than people? No, but I have self-interest, and that doesn't make me self-obsessed, right? but also the management of this river, the creation of these systems for the sake of New York and the benefits that we have survived off of as a community because of that. In a certain way, we owe a debt to the city for protecting this. I think we are always writing stories as individuals, and we're all engaged in those stories at a personal level, at a municipal level, at a state level, at a community level. One of the things that I think we're all subconsciously asking ourselves is, what is the story now? It's going to be interesting to see, what is the story we're going to write? It's either going to be a love story or a war story.
Part 3, The Whole Farm Plan.
In the late 1980s to the early 1990s, the city tried to impose new, strict regulations on farmers to improve water quality, which basically meant keeping cow poop and other agricultural runoff out of the water supply. However, one thing the city wanted farmers to do was to create large land buffers around every bit of water on their land, which would have carved away farmland and pasture land and rendered farms unusable. This was obviously unacceptable. So farmers organized and negotiated with the city in a separate process to the negotiations with the watershed towns. What came out of it was something called the Whole Farm Plan. The city paid farmers to modernize, and it created a watershed agricultural council to manage things. Let's hear from one longtime dairy farmer in Delhi, New York, about how this went down.
Yeah, you get up 5:30, milk your cows, feed them, and then you come back for breakfast, then you go back out and do chores, clean the stables, red manure. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you start feeding cows again and milk at 5 and done by 7:30, 8. So it's a very long day. 7 days a week. Farming is tough. There's no two ways about it. But it's what we do. This is how we make our living. My name is Fred Hunneke. I was chairman of the Watershed Agricultural Council for 12 years. I worked on farms since I was 14 years old. We milked cows for 35 years before I retired. Dairy farming was pretty dominant here in the Catskills, and especially right in the 1930s. There was approximately 3,500 dairy farms here. Gradually, that number has been declining. Unfortunately, we're down to about 50 dairies. The community activity revolved around the dairy industry. Everybody in church was a dairy farmer. Everybody at the schools was dairy farming. Here in the Catskills, we are limited by our geography. We don't have any major cities. We don't have airports. We don't have a railroad. We don't have the interstate highway system. The industry kind of drifted down to the southwest and the far west because of economy of scale. What started to fill that vacuum was the beef industry. We're getting more vegetable farmers and more small animal farmers. It becomes a food shed, and that's important for the city. In 1986, Congress passed the Safe Drinking Water Act. In 1989, they passed the surface water treatment rule. Any municipality with a surface water system was going to have to build a filtration plant. The city knew that the cost of that was between $5 and $7 billion to build. $7 billion is just about the budget of New York City in 1990. So they decided that they would just draw up this set of regulations. I joked sometimes it was drawn up by people in a windowless room that had no idea what the real world was like. They didn't want you farming anywhere near 500 to 1,000 feet from the edge of a brook or a stream. Well, if you look at the geography of the Catskills, every single valley has a water course. So any farm within that valley can't use any of their land within 500 or 1,000 feet of that stream. That takes the whole farm. We knew that we were in trouble. And I thought, this is going to put us out of business. There's no way that we can operate a farm and adhere to these regulations. Farmers just couldn't do that. It was impossible. They started to hold meetings about what these regulations were going to be. The meetings were chaotic. People were furious. The state police came to all the meetings because people were talking about, you know, taking the guns off the wall. And then they had a T-shirt with a cow with a diaper on it and all that political nonsense. A lot of animosity. The reason that it was contentious was because there was still a memory of the original takings from when they built the reservoirs. So all of a sudden, here comes the city again. But the agricultural community knew that if we were going to survive, we were going to have to come up with a solution. They had started to form a task force. I give those guys a lot of credit. They met for a solid year. And what came out of that was the guiding document for the whole farm plan program. The three basic tenets of the program were that it would be fully funded by the city of New York, would be locally controlled, and be voluntary. The voluntary portion of that took the most time to negotiate. They said, you're going to have to get 85% of the farmers to sign up for the program. We started to have kitchen meetings. We had one here, right in that dining room table. We got 85%, and the program just grew. We looked at this program as beneficial to our farms, not only to the economics of my farm. It's going to be better for my cattle. It's going to be better for water quality. Farmers are environmentalists, whether you want to believe it or not. But a lot of times, the economics of farming won't allow them to be the environmentalists that they want to be. And this farm, we put a concrete barnyard with a fence around it. That used to be a big muddy mess. The runoff from the barnyard goes into a drainage field. There is a waterer in each paddock so that the cows drank their water at the pasture and didn't come down and stand in a brook to drink. Everything was about keeping that water coming through the brook clean, all of those projects, and that was all free. All we had to do was maintain it. The city shovels millions and millions of dollars in here. Most of the money that goes into this program come from ratepayers. You know, the city became the gorilla in the room. But the gorilla showed up with bags of money and was willing to negotiate with us through the task force and still negotiate whenever anything comes up. I can just see some people in New York City saying, are you joking with me? You're going to take millions of dollars and give it to a bunch of farmers upstate? But we took it very seriously. We treat this money as if it was our own, and we don't squander it. When you sign up for the program, there's a planner and an engineer, and they look at your farm, and they determine what projects need to be done for water quality. Everything that we do had to be based on science. The farmer's part of the planning team. It's mainly livestock farms, because that's where your manure is, that's where your pathogens are. With vegetable farms, you do have pesticides and runoff from fields, because they do use composted cow manure, so there still has to be a whole farm plan there. This has been an experience, coming up with a program to benefit thousands of people within a 2,000 square mile radius. We didn't plan it, but we became a model for watershed protection nationally. I'm pretty proud of this whole thing. I really am.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Views from the Watershed.
This program was excerpted from episodes of an audio tour in podcast form, originally produced in 2021 and 2024. Listen to and download the complete episodes, get a route map and other info at
walkingthewatershed.com/podcasttour.